The church's one foundation, played by Anna Brandt on the new Casavant pipe organ at Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, live from that church here in the second hour of Issues Etc. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. During the next half hour, we're going to discuss the organ in Christian music and in Christian worship. Dr. Paul Grimm will be our guest. He's Executive Director of the Commission on Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And as I mentioned before, you heard Anna Brandt, the Director of Music at Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, playing live for us there, our opening theme. Village Lutheran is going to be having an organ dedication of that new Casavant organ this Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. Dr. Paul Grimm, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
The basic question, I guess, really has to be that why is it that if you walk into most churches, the vast majority of churches, anywhere throughout the world, almost anywhere throughout the world, you will find this instrument, the organ, more often than not a pipe organ?
Well, to answer that question, you really have to go back a little bit in history to talk about congregational singing and its origins itself. Because you see, before the Reformation, singing in the church was pretty much limited to choirs. And they, in fact, sang on behalf of the congregation the entire service, both parts of the liturgy that we consider and also hymns that were a part of that liturgy. And it was prior to the Reformation, there was the beginning attempt to have congregations sing some songs, and they were very limited in scope, usually just one stanza of folk songs of a religious nature. But as your guests on Issues Etc. have described before, Luther's attempts at writing hymns for people to sing began the process. It didn't happen right off the bat, but began the process of encouraging congregations to sing. I'm going to skip a lot of that history and just sort of push forward to the end of the 16th century as it became more and more prevalent for congregations to be singing. Singing without accompaniment proved to be sometimes rather difficult. And in fact, in the historical records where we find organs being introduced as accompanying congregations, it was precisely usually indicated so that they would have the right pitch and so that they could stay together. You can imagine if congregations were not used to singing together, it could be difficult to make that happen. Why the organ, though, is then the question specifically you ask. And the answer to that, really, if you think back 300 years or 400 years ago, there was no other instrument that could accomplish what the organ can do, namely to be able to enable the people to sing together and to lead them in that singing. And so it's a fascinating development. You had individual instrumentalists that could play lute or could play recorders and other instruments, but none of those would have had the power and the majesty of an organ that could bring together an entire congregation of singers and not be overwhelmed by the singers.
And so then, in the intervening years, it seems, since it became the standard instrument for congregational singing, and ergo also for the other liturgical elements in Christian worship, we have come to simply associate it with church music.
Very much so. I mean, in terms of something to take its place, it wouldn't have been until the piano was developed in the mid-18th century that you would start to have had another instrument that could at least begin to produce enough sound to do what the organ could do. And really, it wouldn't have been until the 20th century and the advent of electronic instruments that you would begin to have the opportunity for a single individual. I mean, you could have a whole orchestra of people playing their instruments to lead, but for one person to control and to be able to produce enough sound to do that leading, it wasn't even until the 20th century when that was possible for something other than the organ to be that instrument.
What is it about the instrument itself, about the organ, that makes it a good blend with the human voice?
I would say the primary benefit and advantage that an organ has over other instruments, not all instruments, but over instruments that are going to do this kind of leading of song, is that it produces sound in the same way that we sing, and that is with air. If you think of all the pipes in an organ, one pipe for each pitch and different shapes and sizes of pipes for different kinds of sounds, compare that to the fact that the human voice is really a pipe. in which wind is blown. The lungs are filled with air. That's the reservoir in the pipe organ. That air is pushed through a little flue in the case of most pipes, like on a whistle, and that's really where your vocal cords are at. And then your mouth makes all the different shapes to produce the sounds, vowels and consonants. And that's part of the way that the pipes are built, too, to have different kinds of colors and sounds. And so it's producing sound in the same way, and so it, in a sense, it complements the voice in a very natural way. I mentioned all these different colors and sounds in a pipe organ, and also then on electronic organs that try to imitate those sounds. You have what is called the basic organ sound. It's the principal sound, or diapason is another name for that sound. And, I mean, it really is just sort of the natural organ sound, and it comes in a variety of pitches, but it's usually it's one of the louder sounds in the instrument that you have, and that sort of forms the backbone of pipe organ sound. And that really, the voice blends very well with that, and it has such a natural way of working with voices to lead them in worship.
Some people will look at it. It looks complicated. They are very overwhelming instruments to look at. And then they listen to it and they say, it sounds like old church music to me. Maybe this instrument, the pipe organ, is just an antiquated kind of an anachronism in the church, because we don't use it most any other place. Maybe at the baseball game occasionally, maybe elsewhere, but it's antiquated. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, well, sadly, the baseball game is becoming antiquated as DJs are replacing the ballpark organist. In regard to the use of the organ, first of all, it is not becoming antiquated. Interestingly enough, there has been a surge in the last 10, 15 years to build new instruments for concert halls around the country and world. And we're talking instruments in the, $2 million range in some cases, probably. I mean, very monstrous, big instruments that are just a phenomenal testament to the fact that the organ does have staying power in its own right. Within the church, indeed, you can quickly associate the organ with sort of an antiquated approach, is what they've always done, it's the tradition. But at the same time, the organ has shown a tremendous staying power. It really still is the best instrument that a single person controls to be able to lead singing. You can use a synthesizer, you can use a piano, you can amplify that sound so that it's loud enough. But for something that has the same qualities as the voice to lead it, it really still speaks well for itself. And I think that it will continue to do that in the future, not exclusively. I do think that there has been an opening up in recent decades to look at other types of instruments that may also serve to lead congregational song. And there can be a good place for the use of some of those instruments in worship. But I think the organ will probably continue to occupy some semblance of its own right. Its place in that category.
Let's talk about the organist himself or herself. This is I've watched you, Paul, from a distance play the organ, and it's not something that I think I could ever master. The simple coordination. I mean, people who have mastered the piano for years have told me I just couldn't handle the organ. It requires me to do too many things at once. Talk about the task of playing the organ.
Sure. I would have the same comments to make about a baseball player swinging the bat. Too complicated for me, I think. It is indeed a different thing, and I think that's the important thing to realize. Each musical instrument has different expectations and requirements. I mean, think of the things an organist doesn't have to do. I'm not responsible for the pitch that the pipes make. I mean, if you're a violinist, where you place your finger precisely determines what the pitch will be. And if it's just, a couple millimeters off, the pitch is flat or sharp. And so, I mean, there's expectations of other instruments, too, that the organ does not even require. But indeed, the coordination issue is certainly one of importance. To be able to play hands and feet together, and then to be manipulating the various stops that turn on and off the various different pipes, sets of pipes in the organ, I mean, that does require careful study and then careful preparation for actually playing the instrument, whether in services or in concerts. And so it's like anything else, though, a skill that is learned is one that, you learn it well, carefully, over a period of time, and it is something that is just, it becomes natural to you.
Are we running out of organists? I mean, I'm not talking about people who could, but I'm talking about people who've taken the kind of training and years of training that it takes to do this at a level of competency and mastery. Are we running out of such people in the church?
Well, it is a challenge. There is no doubt of that. And churches are having more difficulty finding someone who is capable of playing and or willing to learn to play. The American Guild of Organists, which is a national group of about 20,000 members, I believe, that promotes the pipe organ and learning the instrument and more about it, they keep track each year of the number of students who are actually studying to be, who are organ majors in colleges and universities. And they report numbers showing that there are slight declines taking place. I don't know what the numbers were many years ago, but I think probably there are less now, and it's because, no doubt, there are so many other competing interests. The number of students learning to play any instrument is in many cases less, especially keyboard instruments. And it's always a challenge to try to convince youngsters who really ought to be the ones studying these instruments that this is important to do when you have so many other things such as sports and other activities that just didn't exist many years ago. And those are certainly worthwhile activities too, but it's that balance that's always a challenge. So congregations struggle, and especially in more remote areas, sometimes congregations simply cannot find someone who can play.
Maybe here's a bit of an answer. I have noticed, and this is just a little personal anecdote, we go to a church where it's very full on many Sundays. Sometimes we're driven up into the balcony where the organ is to find a seat. My son, who is 8 going on 9, is fascinated by the pipe organ. He's fascinated by the way it looks, by watching the organists play, by the sound. He is completely fascinated by this thing. And I'm wondering if that fascination among little children with this great instrument, this giant instrument, might be the open door for not only preserving this kind of church music that serves the proclamation of God's word so well, but of producing the next generation of people who can serve us this way.
Well, I think that certainly, there are opportunities there that we have to continue to exploit. The American Guild of Organists that I mentioned, they host a number of what they call pipe organ encounters of each year, which are geared toward children. Probably, I don't know what ages exactly they do this, but they have, I think, both elementary and high school levels. And it's pretty much focused or targeted toward youngsters who play piano and who have perhaps some interest in learning about the organ. But I think there are all kinds of opportunities and ways to spark that excitement and interest like you describe with your son. And just a little aside, in California, in Los Angeles, they've just recently dedicated the Walt Disney Concert Hall. It's a new symphonic concert hall in L.A., and it's included there, as in other places in the country now, there's a new pipe organ. This whole hall was designed by this very famous architect. I can remember his last name, Gehry, G-E-H-R-Y, a very famous and innovative architect. And he's trying to, sort of take the themes of Walt Disney, Disneyland, and bringing that into the hall. And he also was intimately involved in designing the organ that is in place, or a very large instrument. And it is unlike any organ that's ever been built in terms of design. And people have described it looking like a box of French fries. Or, just like pickup sticks thrown around, the way that it's been designed. But that kind of interest that will be sparked by something like that, I think, will probably sort of take it all to a new level when people have an opportunity to be exposed to that.
We're talking with Dr. Paul Grimm, Executive Director of the Commission on Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, about the organ in Christian worship. Paul, we're going to hear another piece here performed live from Village Lutheran Church by Anna Brandt, the Director of Music there at Village Lutheran. Now, this I am a musical novice. I know nothing of music. I simply appreciate it from afar and at a layman's level. The piece is Fugue and Chaconne in C by Dietrich Buxtehude.
Buxtehude.
Can you tell me anything about this?
Yeah, Dietrich Buxtehude was a very famous organist in the latter half of the 17th century in the city of Lübeck, which was, or was he in Hamburg? Now I don't remember myself. But he's famous because J.S. Bach went to visit him when Bach was a young man. He'd heard of this famous organist, and so he wanted to go visit, and he actually stayed for 4 months to study with him. And that was only about 2 years before Buxtehude died, and so it was very fortuitous that Bach had the opportunity to be influenced by such a great artist. And he was playing, he was organist in a very large church with a grand instrument, and he was really the first to take organ music that was being composed to a virtuosic level and just sort of letting it sometimes be very much a showpiece. Also, though, he did do a number of hymn-based pieces as well, based on all the chorales. But the piece that you're describing, I don't know exactly which one it is offhand until I start hearing it, but a fugue and a chaconne. Let me just describe what those two little technical terms are. There are musical terms that describe a style composition, and a chaconne, I'll go backwards first, is usually sort of a theme and variation. And with Books de Houda, when he wrote his chaconnes, he would write simple, like a three or four measures, so just about, you know, it could be anywhere from 5 to 10 seconds is all, is a repetitive pattern, usually in the pedal, and they'll be in the bass line. And above that, then, are various variations that are played just to sort of explore all the possibilities of ways of accompanying this little theme. A fugue, on the other hand, is a little different than that. It is a there's a melodic phrase of a certain length that first enters just played by itself, and then that same phrase, that same melody comes in again in a lower or higher pitch, and often in a different key, and then it finishes, and it comes in again, and sometimes 3-4 times it comes in, and then during the course of the piece, for there may be episodes where there is no theme, and then the theme comes back in, and you're sort of always listening for that theme to see how the composer is going to treat it and how he's going to do the, you know, something new and different with it throughout the piece. Bach, of course, student Books de Houda, obviously learned a lot from him, but in all the synthesis that he did in his composition, he really was the crowning achievement when he wrote his fugues. But Books de Houda was certainly a master from whom he learned much of that technique.
Let's listen to this piece played by Anna Brandt live from Village Lutheran Church in Ladue. That was the prelude, Fugue in Chaconne in C, played on the new organ at Village Lutheran Church in Ladue by Ann Brandt, director of music there at Village Lutheran. By the way, folks, Village Lutheran at 9237 Clayton Road in Ladue invites you to the Reformation Day organ dedication service this Sunday, October the 31st at 10 a.m. The service is going to include choirs and instrumentalists as well as special music on their new organ. There's a dedication on this organ there. It says, this Casavant pipe organ is dedicated to the glory of the triune God and given in loving memory of the Reverend H.C. and Estelle Klaus by their daughter, Audrey. Paul Grimm, thank you very much for being our guest and giving us a brief history here and a little time here on the organ in Christian music.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
And a special thanks to Anna Brandt and the people at Village Ladue for lending us their sound live here on Issues, etc. Dr. Paul Grimm is executive director of the Commission on Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. That service at Village Lutheran is 10 a.m. this coming Sunday morning. I encourage you to attend. It's open to the public. It's 9237 Clayton Road in Ladue. When we come back from this break, we've got open lines for your questions and your comments. Stay with us.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What was the Protestant Reformation really all about? Who were its major figures? How did the culture and the politics of that day play into the Reformation movement? Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for October is actually two books, Volumes 1 and 2 of the Renaissance and Reformation Movements by Dr. Lewis Spitz. These books are considered the gold standard in Reformation studies. Each volume is $23.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order the Renaissance and Reformation Movements from Concordia Publishing House. Call them toll-free any weekday at 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, the Renaissance and Reformation Movements. 1-800-325-3040.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. There are concerns that some voters in the 11 states where marriage is on the ballot may be confused about whether their yes vote will protect marriage or harm it. Stuart Shepherd says, don't worry. A yes vote will express your support for marriage.
It's very possible some people in Kentucky who sincerely want to protect marriage may actually vote the wrong way. Ken Ostrander is with the Family Foundation.
Our volunteers and workers across the state have run into a number of folks who are vehemently opposed to same-sex marriage, and they think that's what this issue is about, so they want to go out and say no.
But in fact, a yes vote is what's needed to protect marriage. John Poulton is with Focus on the Family.
There was an example from another state where a pastor took an entire busload of people to vote on the marriage amendment and actually voted no, later realizing that they needed to vote yes.
He says in some cases, it may be a simple misunderstanding.
In some cases, homosexual rights organizations have purposefully put out misinformation to try to confuse voters.
He says people in the states where the amendment is on the ballot need to make sure they clearly understand how to vote and to help others understand as well.
This is a marriage protection amendment, and so in order to protect marriage, they need to vote yes on this amendment.
This is the most important issue because it deals with the cornerstone of our society. It's the foundation of the foundation. Marriage is the foundational covenant of family, and family is the foundation of society.
And to vote yes is in favor of marriage as one man and one woman. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepherd.
While yes means support of marriage in 10 of the states that will be voting, in Montana, people will vote for the amendment. Ostrander says a positive affirmation of marriage by the states will send a strong message to Washington in favor of passing a federal marriage amendment. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Do you want more of God's grace? Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights is a Bible-believing church, faithful to the Scriptures, a place for the whole family, a community gathered around Christ that cares with a vibrant historic Christian liturgy. Bethany Lutheran Church is located at 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights. Visit them at www.bethanylcms.org.
The literary work, The Renaissance and Reformation Movements, is our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October. It's written by the late Dr. Lewis Spitz, a former history professor at Stanford University. The Renaissance and Reformation Movements is published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can browse before you buy, issuesetc.org. Click the What's New section. The Renaissance and Reformation Movements, the Book of the Month for October.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to be doing open lines here for a few minutes, and then we'll be talking with Dr. Frank Beckwith about Christians and voting in the last hour of the program. By the way, our guest in the last segment, Dr. Paul Grimm, will also be playing that new Casavant organ at Village Lutheran Church in Ladue at 3 in the afternoon on Sunday, December the 5th, for a special dedication recital service of Advent and Christmas music that falls right there at the beginning of Advent. So on December 5th, mark your calendar, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, that special recital service of Advent and Christmas music played on the newly dedicated Casavant organ at Village Lutheran Church in Ladue. It's open lines. Now, this is something that I noticed when I was watching the second presidential debate. I noticed there was a little interchange. It didn't have a lot to do with the issues, per se. We've talked a lot about the presidential debates with regard to the various issues, their stem cell research and homosexual marriage and abortion. This one is not so much about an issue. This is about It had as much to do with the way we think about the issues as it does with any particular issue. I'm going to let you hear this interchange between President George W. Bush and then a series of sound bites that we put together here from his opponent, Senator John Kerry, and his response to the fact that the president is going to call Senator Kerry a liberal, in fact, the most liberal senator ever. Now, here's the question I have for you. I'd like your answer during this hour of open lines. First of all, do you agree with Senator Kerry when he says that labels just get in the way, they don't matter, they're misrepresentations, they don't fit? You'll hear him say this. Do you agree with that, that whether it's a political label or a religious label, they don't do us any good? They only pigeonhole people. And we've all met someone who says, look, I don't want to be labeled. I don't want to be labeled. I don't fit in any one category. Here's President George W. Bush. He begins this little interchange during the second presidential debate.
First, the National Journal named Senator Kennedy the most liberal senator of all. And that's saying something, that bunch. You might say that took a lot of hard work.
Look, what's really important, John, is the president's just trying to scare everybody here with throwing labels around. I mean, compassionate conservative, what does that mean? I mean, seriously, labels don't mean anything. What means something is, do you have a plan? Don't throw the labels around. Labels don't mean anything. Labels don't fit, ladies and gentlemen.
All right, that was Senator Kerry. He's saying labels don't fit, don't throw them around, don't use them. I think the point he's trying to make is that labels stifle debate, the real exchange of ideas, they mischaracterize people. Do you have a label? Or are you one of those people who says, I can't be pigeonholed by any label. No label fits me. Do you agree, in essence, with Senator Kerry that labels stifle the real exchange of ideas? Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Now, that was the response of Senator Kerry to being called a liberal senator. We have all sorts of labels we use in society, don't we? Liberal, conservative. We even have labels for the presidential candidates. They make up their own labels. They talk about, that was one that Senator Kerry mentioned, a compassionate conservative. Sometimes we multiply the labels and we modify the labels. Neoconservatives. Republicans, there's a label. Democrat, there's a label. Independent, that's also a label. It's a label that where we're saying, look, I can't be labeled either a Republican or a Democrat. And you can make up as many as you want. What do you think about this? Don't label me, because that would mischaracterize me. And let's not label one another. We hear it very often. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, I'm not just asking this question with regard to the political labels that are so common among us. What about labels in the church? We talk about, well, here's my label, Lutheran. Now, I expect that to mean something. At least, in my mind, it means something. It may mean something different to someone else who also goes by the same label. In fact, I can almost be certain that it might mean something different to someone else who goes by the same label. Is it wrong for us to label ourselves as Christians? Lutheran, Presbyterian, Episcopalian, Catholic? Does this get in the way of church unity? Does it get in the way of us recognizing each other as brothers and sisters? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Or, maybe, perhaps, you're one of those who thinks that labels are useful. How could we navigate the world of ideas without labels? We would all have to stand around explaining ourselves to one another at great length, rather than saying, by the way, I'm a Republican. Or, by the way, I'm a Lutheran. Or call in numbers 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines, issues, etc. I'd like your answers to those questions. You know, labels do apply in two different ways. For every liberal, there's a conservative. There are good labels. Now, the whole liberal label might be a bad thing in someone's mind. To someone else, it might be good. There are good labels and bad labels, like you're a criminal. There's a label. But then there's also law-abiding citizen. Now, they're useful, aren't they? 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. I come home. My son shows me his little science project. It has an A-plus on it. I say, son, you're a good student. I've labeled him. But he doesn't resent it. He doesn't complain, Dad, don't pigeonhole me as a good student. So, for some reason, it's only the negative labels that we want to avoid. And on that issue of liberal, since it was the president who brought it up there in the debate, calling his opponent, Senator Kerry, a liberal, I did not hear the president whining because he was called a conservative. Why is it that conservatives very seldom complain about the label conservative, even though it's just as much a label? In fact, they embrace it. Many of them embrace it with great pride. Whereas, as often as not, liberals, people who are genuinely liberal in their thinking, don't like being called liberals. What do you think? Is the complaining about labels just a technique used by liberals to either hide what it is they believe or to, they say that labels stifle debate. Is it a technique used to stifle debate, to avoid what they really, saying what it is they really believe? Our call in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Up first in this hour, Daryl is on the line, and he's calling from his car. Daryl, welcome to Issues, Etc. Hey, Daryl, welcome. All right, here we have Daryl. Are you there?
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. Well, like I said, my name is Daryl. It's a label. It's how people identify me. If someone says, that person's a lot like Daryl, I hope it's a compliment.
So your name, even your own name is a label.
Right. We label all the time. I mean, it's how we identify things. You know, an apple's an apple, but we have different types of apples because I like to chew Gala apples. They're nice and crisp. You know, so labels are a necessity for proper communication. It helps people identify something along some kind of lines.
Okay, so why do you think it is that people say, don't label me, or let's not toss around the labels, let's not throw around the labels? They, or as Senator Kerry said several times there in that debate, labels don't mean anything. Why do you think that is?
Well, what he would like you to say that labels don't mean anything, but labels do mean something. Usually, if something says it's like a Cadillac, that means it's of high quality. You know, so labels mean something to people. And so, if you're trying to not be pigeonholed so that you can get a wider spectrum of voters, well, of course, let's not be labeled because that may narrow my spectrum of voters.
All right, Daryl, thank you very much. That's a pretty astute political observation. I mean, if you're going to try and get the widest possible number of people to vote for you, you're going to say, don't label me. Because the minute you say I'm this or I'm that, or I associate myself with the liberal or the conservative, or perhaps sometimes even the Republican or the Democrat, you've immediately cut off part of those people who are going to vote for you. They will, because of the label, say, okay, I know who this person is and I don't like what I see and I'm not going to be voting for them. That's the political aspect of it. What's going on when we find Christians who say, don't label me? And not with regard to their politics, but with regard to their theology. I remember, now we haven't had a caller like this in a long time, but I remember during my first days, I think they were just trying it out on me because I was new, during my first days doing issues, etc., we got a number of callers who, when we talked about Lutheran or Calvinist or Presbyterian or Catholic, they would call and they'd say, well, I go to this church, but I consider myself just a Christian. I don't think of myself as a Lutheran. I don't think of myself as a Catholic. I'm a Christian. If we are not ashamed to be called, say, a Republican or conservative Republican or a compassionate conservative, what's the deal with not wanting to be labeled for our theological beliefs? Is it that you don't believe anything? Is it that you don't want to be labeled? Is it that you can't identify what it is you believe? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Daryl says, look, my name is a label, and that's how people identify me. It's a good idea. What about the rest of you? Has your pastor ever told you, I don't want to be labeled as a conservative or a liberal? It just doesn't fit me. Those words don't mean anything. If so, what do you think drives him to think like this? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We hear it from the politicians very often when they're trying to avoid. Well, what is it that the president did? He said he's a liberal and this is how he votes. Well, Senator Kerry, wisely, as a wise politician, says, I want to distance myself from those particular votes. So rather than saying I didn't vote that way, or rather than saying I shouldn't have voted that way, he says, don't label me. Don't toss the labels around. They don't do anything. They don't mean anything. They don't have any force. Now, I can understand a politician doing that when it comes to political issues. I have a harder time understanding why it is a Christian would not want to be labeled when it comes to what it is they believe. We're supposed to be bold and upfront, truth and advertising about what we believe. You can drive down the road of any small town and you can see church after church on Main Street. There's going to be Catholic. There's going to be Lutheran. There's going to be UCC. It's all a label. They're all labels. They all mean something. At the very least, they distinguish one church from another. There's the Methodist Church. Hey, there's the Apostolic Church. More common nowadays, in the same small town, along with the Baptists and the Presbyterians and all the other labels that you'll see on the church signs, you'll just see Fellowship Church, Community Church. Far more general and kind of, when you at least say, well, I think I kind of know what a Baptist believes, but I don't know what a community church believes. Now, granted, they may not be Baptist or Catholics. In fact, one might say that the whole non-denominational movement is populated to a large degree with Christians who have been trying to distance themselves from past labels. Most of them weren't born non-denominational. They were born, well, most of them were born Roman Catholic. That's the greatest factory of non-denominational Christians there ever was. Many of them may have been born Lutheran or Presbyterian or Methodist or anything else. And now they say, look, I'm non-denominational. A denomination is nothing but a label. It's another word for a label. So I'm non-labeled, non-labelable. But still they believe things, right? I'm a mere Christian. Well, what does that mean? John Kerry says he's a Christian, and he has very different beliefs than his opponent George W. Bush. Very different beliefs. And those two men both have very different beliefs from me, and I say I'm a Christian too, which is why I narrow the field. Don't you? I narrow the field by saying, I am a Christian, and if you want to know in particular what it is I believe, just other than I just love the baby Jesus, I am a Lutheran. And if you want to know even in more detail what I believe, I'm not just any old kind of Lutheran. I'm a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Lutheran. And actually, there's even more detailed qualifiers that we could put on it even there. Because that even that specific thing, I'm a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Lutheran, may not tell you exactly what it is I believe. Here again is that interchange between President George W. Bush and the responses of Senator Kerry.
First, the National Journal named Senator Kennedy the most liberal senator of all. And that's saying something, that bunch. You might say that took a lot of hard work.
Look, what's really important, John, is the president's just trying to scare everybody here with throwing labels around. I mean, compassionate conservative, what does that mean? I mean, seriously, labels don't mean anything. What means something is, do you have a plan? Don't throw the labels around. Labels don't mean anything. Labels don't fit, ladies and gentlemen.
You know, it finally just occurred to me. A lot of Christians agree with Senator Kerry on this very issue. They do. A lot of non-denominational Christians, a lot of Christians who are in denominations but don't like being called, I don't like being called a Methodist. Just call me a Christian. They agree with Senator Kerry. Labels don't mean anything. Labels don't help. And labels don't fit. Maybe you're one of those Christians. I want to hear from you. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Is it really true, either in politics or in religion, that labels don't mean anything? Now, I should say in all fairness, there are non-denominational Christians who avoid the other labels that other Christians embrace because they don't believe what those Christians believe. They have, one might call it, lowest common denominator denominationalism, the lowest common denomination, wherein they say anything that is particularly this or that or the other thing, I avoid that. I just don't go into details. I keep my theology at the lowest common denominator. If you ask me what I think about this or that, I might have an opinion. Interestingly enough, they do on almost every theological issue. But they avoid the labels because they specifically are trying to avoid the various theologies represented by those other labels. So what do you end up with? They say, I'm a Christian. Well, what does that mean? And if you ask them, are there Christians in other denominations? Are there Christians in denominations? Oh, yes, there are. Well, then what makes you different from them? You see, it's kind of a, I'm not anything else. I'm the none of the above category. What can you tell me about your non-denominational church? Well, we're not Lutheran, we're not Catholic, we're not Presbyterian, we're not Methodist, we're not Pentecostal, we're not this, we're not that. Well, tell me what you are. Crickets. Week, 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 week. I can tell you what I'm not, but I can't exactly tell you what I am. What if I did that in politics? What if I told you, folks, you know, I have an aspiring political career here, but I'll tell you one thing, I'm not a Republican. And I'm not a Democrat either. I'm not independent nor libertarian, certainly not constitutional party. I'm not Reform Party. I'm not Green Party. I'm not the Communist Party or the Socialist Party. Eventually, after enough of that, you're going to say to me, but what are you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Josh is calling from his car.
Hello, Todd.
Hello.
I'd like to suggest a very Lutheran reason why some people might not want to call themselves a Baptist or a Methodist or anything else. They might be just wanting to focus attention on Christ by saying that they're a Christian, and they might, instead of drawing attention to the theology of Luther or Wesley or anybody else, they might just want to draw attention to the teachings of the Bible and of the Christian Church, the Church Catholic.
Okay, so let's just pursue this for a second, because I understand there are people, and that would be their rationale. Let's just pursue whether it holds water here, Josh. If I were just to say, I'm a Christian, what does that tell you? What can you say for sure I've told you by embracing that label, Christian?
Well, I see what you're getting at, Todd. It could mean a lot of things to a lot of different people, so you definitely have a point there.
I mean, you are going to, if I say I'm a Christian, you might think, okay, I think we're believing the same thing in the basics here. You're going to have to pursue it more in more detail, aren't you?
I guess. I don't know if there's really a label you can... I guess there are certain labels you could use, such as I'm a Missouri Synod Lutheran, that would be specific enough to really let people know what it is you believe.
So. Why do you think it is, Josh, that many of these same Christians who say, look, I'm just Christian, have no problem with all the labels in the political realm, liberal, conservative, ultra-conservative, right-wing, I'm a right-wing conservative Republican. They embrace these things in politics.
I would suggest that most people who call themselves Christians have more knowledge of the political nuances and the difference between political parties than they do the intricacies of various doctrines.
Good.
Or various denominations, I should say.
Good point, Josh. Good point.
But, I'd just like to throw out that I am actually a member of a non-denominational church that recites the Apostles' Creed, usually every week.
Good.
Yeah, and we also kneel at the front of the altar to receive the communion. So.
Well, I don't know whether that matters or not. I mean, you can kneel or stand. Makes no difference here. I'm gratified to hear that there's a non-denominational church that's actually not abandoning the historic creeds of the church. I wish that there were more Lutheran churches that would follow that example. They happily embrace or at least they say they embrace the label Lutheran, but then they'll abandon the historic creeds of the church. At least they won't use them. I mean, they won't deny them, but they won't use them. Kind of like that pair of golf clubs that you keep around because, you know, just in case, but you don't use them. They stay in the closet, collect dust. Go figure. A non-denominational church that's reciting the Apostles' Creed while so many churches that have clear confessions are just letting them fall into disuse. Okay. Could it be, Josh suggests that maybe Christians know more about political issues than they do about theology, and so they kind of ignorantly say, I can't be labeled theologically, whereas they're more than willing to embrace the labels in politics. Well, let's think about a basic label like Christian. That is a label too, isn't it? I mean, why, if the labels, you know, are too restrictive, why even call yourself a Christian? Did you ever think about that? We've had people call and say, I'm just a Christian. I'm not a that Christian or a thus Christian. I'm just a Christian. Well, why even call yourself a Christian? Because that says something to somebody that you may not intend for it to say. Or let's take it into the realm of politics. If you could find someone, let's say, here's a good example, Bill O'Reilly with the radio show and the television show. He's one of these guys, don't label me. Don't label me. I can't be pinned down by any labels. He doesn't like the labels, at least as they're applied to him. So he makes a point. I mean, it's really kind of his shtick to always be dodging the label. Just when you think Bill O'Reilly's a Republican, whoosh, he zigs when you think he was going to zag, and he turns out to be something else. And so you can't figure out what it is he is. It's his thing. Is he an American? Why even use that label? I mean, that is somewhat restrictive, too. Don't label me. Why accept that label as American? And in the Christian sense, why accept the label Christian if you don't like the labels? We're going to have open lines for the next hour. It's anything you want to talk about. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We're coming up on a break. Frank Beckwith was going to be with us, but he's fallen ill, and we do not want to put him through the rigors of an hour-long conversation when he's not feeling as well as he could. So it's open lines for the remainder of Issues, etc. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Here's another question that I have for you. Perhaps we could pick this up on the other side of the break. We had someone write us recently about prenatal screening. I'm not just talking about the sonogram. The sonogram is where they actually look into the womb and be able to see the baby. That's not what I'm talking about. And I'm not talking about routine kind of how's the baby doing, where's the head, let's measure everything going on here. I'm talking about the kind of screening for things like Down syndrome, genetic anomalies. Many of you who have kids may have never done this. For some OBGYNs, it might even be routine practice. When the woman says she's pregnant at a certain point in the pregnancy, he recommends, let's do a screening for this. We can discover what's going on there in the womb, and we can see whether or not the child has this or that, some sort of a genetic anomaly, some sort of other kind of problem. Can we do anything about it? Maybe not. What do you think about mothers having prenatal screening in this age of abortion on demand, in this age where an OBGYN is just as likely to tell you that if your child has Down syndrome in the womb after a screening, you know, you might not want to go through with this? What do you think about that? Is it a bad idea? Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And the conversation, of course, continues on the issue of whether or not labels are a good thing, whether or not labels in politics or labels in religion get in the way of the free exchange of ideas. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Open lines continues in the next hour on issues, etc. And we will reschedule. This will be the second time with Dr. Frank Beckwith to talk about Christians and voting. Open Lines is next. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.